KSFR programming is funded in part by the Reva and David Logan Foundation, keeping watch for the strategies that help create a more informed and just future for all.
Welcome to Here and There. We search near and far to bring you accurate, timely information about important news stories here in New Mexico and the American Southwest, and there, everywhere else. I'm Dave Marish. Usually, when we say someone's looking for trouble, it's meant as a warning because the assumption is they're looking to cause trouble just for the hell of it. But Andrew Lustig is always looking for trouble that he and his team of global outreach doctors, physicians, naturopathic doctors like himself, psychologists and acupuncturists, nurses and technicians can help relieve. 9 months ago, when first we conversed on Here and There, Dr. Lustig was just back from helping in northern Jordan, right along the Syrian border, in a huge, well-established refugee camp called Zaatar, and in a few smaller, more improvised camps, all filled with Syrian refugees. Now he's back from another tour in the Middle East, this time in the Jordanian capital of Amman, and then to Iraqi Kurdistan, from Erbil, east of Mosul, to Dohuk, which is near Iraq's western border with Turkey and Syria. With visits to Iraq's Nineveh province and one of the biggest and a few of the fastest growing camps for refugees fleeing from the Battle of Mosul, the Islamic State's last major stronghold in Iraq. Back in beautiful northern New Mexico for just a few days, and already Andrew Lustig was monitoring the aftermath of a 6.7 Richter scale earthquake in the southeastern Philippines. The UN's Global Disaster Alert Agency had predicted, quote, this earthquake is expected to have a high humanitarian impact. Well, if the early reports hold up, I guess we'd have to say that things could have been worse, but there was serious damage. At least 8 people killed, 200 injured, and 1,000 homes badly damaged near the provincial capital city of Surigao. Dr. Andrew Lustig, of Global Outreach Doctors, welcome back to Here and There. And what's your read on the situation in the Philippines? I know that President Duterte went out to Surigao. I know that local forces are being marshaled to deal with the aftermath. Is it your assumption that this is something that the local authorities can handle more or less on their own?
Thanks for having me, Dave, and thanks for that good question about the Philippines. You know, the Philippines is made up of hundreds of islands, and we've worked there, and the Tacloban typhoon was pretty significant. But since then, the Philippine government has brought on extensive expat training organizations to help them save lives in advance of incoming typhoons, which they are prone to very regularly. And so they have quite an extensive alert system and a system to move villagers away from the coast. And prior to Typhoon Haiyan several years ago, they didn't have these systems in place. Several of our friends, some from the UK, have been spending the last couple of years really sort of helping the Philippine government organize, you know, the movement of villagers from affected areas away and to higher ground and to safe areas. So in this particular case, the short answer or the long answer is that they've learned their lesson from Typhoon Haiyan, and the individuals that did die are real people that have real families, but the quantity of loss of life is substantially less.
Now, when last we talked, you had had experience in the Philippines, and you had, helped out in Greece as well as in Jordan. This global outreach is not new, but I noticed on your Facebook page, and in addition to monitoring the Philippines, Global Outreach Docs is planning a permanent facility in Western Kenya, and you're recruiting volunteers to go out there for a couple of weeks at a time. Is your organization growing into a new phase now?
I would say our organization is not necessarily growing into a new phase, but certainly because actually global health initiatives to provide long-term sustainable care and to enlist locals to take over that care has always been our mission. And we have provided these type of global health initiatives in combination and in addition to disaster deployments for earthquakes and typhoons. What is happening in 2017 for Global Outreach Doctors is that there are several projects concurrently that are sizable. And so the project in Kenya is led by Dr. Brian Boss, one of our medical directors at Global Outreach. It includes bringing medical providers to work in a Western Kenya hospital that a good friend of mine owns, as well as bringing medical educators to work in the nearby nursing school to fill in the gaps for nurses that are training to become RNs, in fill in the gaps in the programs in areas that they might be weaker in. So that might include maternal health, pediatrics, maybe some aspects of trauma. And that project is coming up in April, and we are always looking for physicians, nurses, surgeons. We do have a potential surgical deployment in Kurdistan, northern Iraq, coming up. We're always looking for trauma acupuncturists, paramedics, various projects going on, including something coming up in Nepal as well.
As the project grows and as you plant the Global Outreach Doctors flag in more and more locations and leave behind more and more satisfied customers who take to Facebook and Twitter to praise you, are you finding yourself pulled in a fundraising direction more and more now? And is that a distraction from your first love of actual hands-on helping provide medical care on the scene?
It's a really good question. Very poignant at this time for me personally. I always envisioned that even starting 10 years ago when it was my hands and my suitcases full of medicine under a tree in Africa or in hospitals in well before the Haiti earthquake and then after the Haiti earthquake. I always envisioned that there were much better medical providers than myself and that my true skill to bring to bear to help those that have less is my ability to organize medical providers and organize the relationship with the UNHCR, organize the marketing and fundraising. You know, as a former CEO of a media company for 20 years, my training is primarily, though I am a naturopathic doctor, my training primarily is as a business person. So organizing large groups of people, hopefully in a direction that helps others in this particular case. We rely on donations. We have to build a more sustainable base of donors, as is the case for many small NGOs. But I do find myself sort of meeting with the ministers of health and the directors of hospitals and introducing our physicians to these groups and putting their excellent skills to work in both working with patients directly, but also educating the local provider so that we can create something that's sustainable and so that, you know, they're not sort of reliant on expats coming in and doing the work and leaving and bringing in another expat. And in particular, we really hope to have a surgical mission coming up soon in Kurdistan that will engage a burn and wound surgeon who will be bringing synthetic skin, because the burn victims have very substantial percentages of burns over their body, and there isn't a place to graft skin from. So to make these cases viable for surviving, you need to bring synthetic skin, and that's just not something that is available in Kurdistan at the moment, or if it is, it's, you know, not much. And also the skill to operate with synthetic skin is not available. So our burn and wound surgeon will be bringing her skills and the material to work with and to train the surgeons in Kurdistan. And this mission has not yet been finalized, but we're hopeful.
But your recent mission, which largely was in Kurdistan and in the area of Iraq around the city of Mosul, represented, I guess, something of a rationing of your time and energy. You're not going to get to go out into the field as much as you might hope. And even when you're there, you're again rationing or dividing your time between your greatest pleasure, which is hands-on medical treatment, with more administrative concerns of making connections and setting up and defining projects with local health bureaucracies.
That is the mode that I am in, and the mission recently in Kurdistan, northern Iraq, was primarily a medical needs assessment. And through our connection with our partners, Bring Hope Foundation, and with Drs. Michael and Fred from South Africa, we did visit many refugee camps, medical facilities, hospitals. We met with the required Peshmerga forces, because you really don't do medicine without being involved in some regard with those that grant you permission to these areas. And so it was assessment this medical needs assessment that we came back and met with our medical directors in the States and discussed the need for a 24/7 emergency medical facility in a particular refugee camp. And this medical facility is portable. It's it comes in a large ocean-going freight container, and we are going to staff that with expats as well as locals, and operate that in this refugee camp of 30,000, which is also proximate next to another refugee camp of 25,000. So we expect that as many as 50,000 people will have potential access to our future emergency medical facility.
And this is the Khazar camp that's sort of south and east of Mosul?
Correct. Khazar 1 camp. You know, it's interesting, as you described the geography, the most focus right now, of course, is on Mosul and east. Mosul has been liberated by the Iraqi army and the Peshmerga, while West Mosul is still occupied by IS. And, you know, the victims of IS within just West Mosul, you know, are 500 to 700,000 people. And so when this area does get liberated, hopefully soon, those people, including, you know, those that have escaped, needs significant medical attention. Their gunshot wounds, bombs and all of that. And so, while we're focusing, on Khazar camp, which is in a contained refugee camp, we expect that the amount of refugees is going to swell, and it's going to sort of, inundate all the existing refugee camps, plus the new ones that are being built, plus the medical facilities. So hopefully we'll be in a position to provide additional support.
Well, let's sketch in just a little bit of the background. Mosul is the second largest city after Baghdad in Iraq. It's a little bit more populous than Basra, which is number three. The population estimates are sketchy, in part because people have been fleeing ever since ISIS took over control of Mosul now almost 2 years ago. But the guesstimates are that between the East Bank and the West Bank, the population is something over a million. The East Bank took several months for Iraqi and allied forces to liberate. And the expectation is that the West Bank, which is a little bit more populous, a little bit older, and much denser, narrower streets, more closely packed housing, more densely concentrated population, is going to be both militarily more difficult to take back from the Islamic State, but from a humanitarian standpoint, the proportion of collateral damage, civilian casualties to military casualties is expected to be even higher, so that an already enormous workload for medical volunteers in the camps close to Mosul and back in places like Erbil in Kurdistan, where the triaged most serious cases tend to be taken, or the people who are going to need more long-term treatment. But as difficult a situation as what you confronted a couple of weeks ago in Khazar camp, can only be expected to get, by several magnitudes, more difficult over the next several months.
Yeah, absolutely, Dave. You've got that exactly right. Both the population density within the remaining IS-controlled area, the casualty, potential casualty count. And I even, you know, am concerned about the NGOs that have moved into East Mosul, preparing to receive the West Mosul casualties, because that's just so close to the front line. Now, these are large, experienced, you know, WHO approved NGOs, so I'm sure they know what they're doing. I don't believe that Global Outreach Doctors would go into East Mosul, that close to the front lines. You know, in one particular case in Bartella, Samaritan's Purse came in, and these are all the big boys, you know, with, you know, $1 billion of funding, you know, or more every year. And Samaritan's Purse came in on their own 747. They put an emergency, surgical unit, in Bartella near Mosul. And there's a 12-foot concrete wall around the entire camp. You know, one of our surgical friends is actually working with them. And, you know, it takes enormous resources to sort of work really within the danger zone, very proximate, because of the amount of money needed to be spent for security. And also, to be honest with you, the experience in working in, situations that, you know, you've got to make sure that your next patient coming into that facility isn't wearing a suicide belt. So it's a very thorny position to work that close to the front line.
Let me add two footnotes to that. One, Samaritan's Purse is the medical charity that is led by Franklin Graham, the Reverend Billy Graham's son, and it is, as you say, one of the big boys in the field of emergency medical relief, with a very distinguished pedigree. The other thing is that even though eastern Mosul has been, quote, liberated. It is known that there are sleeper cells and lone wolf terrorists there. And in just the past several days, there has been a pair of really damaging, life-taking bombings, so that the threat, even in the liberated zone of Mosul, is very high. We're going to talk more about what's been going on in that Qasr camp, about 25, 30 miles outside of Mosul, and the first of the great semi-permanent, very large-scale refugee camps for people who are fleeing Mosul and the suburbs around it. But right now, we'll take a brief pause. This is Here and There. I'm Dave Marish. Our guest is Dr. Andrew Lustig of Santa Fe, New Mexico, and Global Outreach Doctors. We'll be back right after these messages. Welcome back to Here and There. I'm Dave Marish. Our guest is Dr. Andrew Lustig of Global Outreach Doctors. He's just back from a tour of duty in the areas surrounding the city of Mosul, the great battleground between Iraqi and allied forces, including considerable help from the United States and the Islamic State. Andrew and his doctors have been working in the Qasr camp, which, as I say, is about 25 miles southeast of the city. Give us a sense of between Qasr 1 and the several associated camps that are really still being set up and built as people arrive. Give us a sense, if you will, of the daily regime of a medical team like Global Outreach Doctors. Who's coming to see you? What kinds of medical needs are they presenting? How do you and your colleagues at Global Outreach Doctors deal with them?
Sure, Dave. Thank you. That's a good question. First, I need to say that the emergency medical facility that we are setting up has not yet been set up. However, having visited many refugee camps in Kurdistan, obviously including Qasr, where we plan on putting this emergency medical clinic, and of course many other refugee camps around the world, the medical issues for the population are roughly pretty similar. If you take a population anywhere in the world of 30,000 in one camp and a next door camp of 20,000, you're going to see similar issues for any population, whether it be in with the Western world or in developing countries. You know, you have the sort of general health issues that primary health care can support and deal with. You have some levels of trauma depending on sort of the surrounding areas. You know, somebody can trip and fall, or you know, be working on a roof somewhere or climbing the top of their tent. And you have issues because there's no substantial cooking facilities. They're using kerosene stoves. So you have, you know, burn injuries. You have issues around, you know, open fire cooking and all of that. You have health issues that relate to poor sanitation. Now, in these refugee camps that are established, UN, UNHCR, WHO, all the major actors have set up, you know, portable latrines. If you go to places in Africa like Kibera, you know, a large impoverished area with 800,000 people and open latrines, you have a much more substantial waste and sanitation hygiene issue. But in the refugee camps, besides primary health care, you know, you're also going to have some acute issues in any population of 30,000, you know, you're going to potentially have some heart attacks. You're going to have some substantial trauma. You know, you may have some infectious disease issues. And, you know, you might even be dealing with, you know, minor viral and bacterial issues as well. Those patients that are seen that need to be referred out will be referred to hospitals in Erbil or Duhok if their condition requires you know, a medical transport to a more substantial facility.
Now, for months now, since the Battle of Mosul began, the hospitals in Erbil, which is a thoroughly modern city in Iraqi Kurdistan, has been sort of the hospital of first resort for those who are badly injured and have been triaged closer to the battlefront and judged that they need either longer term or more sophisticated treatment of their wounds or illnesses. And I take it that already the capacity of the much more modern facilities in Erbil are in danger of being overstressed. And as I say, the battle for West Mosul is likely to be even more casualty productive than the battle for East Mosul.
Yes, of course, I'm no military expert, but from what we are hearing, being on the ground there and through our sources, and you know, we get information from lots of places, both the same places that the general public receives their information, but also from other places that are more industry specific. So we work with INSO, which is International NGO Safety Organization, with offices around the world in probably the most dangerous places. And I have regular text alerts, you know, which roads not to go on, whether an explosion happened, what the casualty count is, or the type of explosion. Was it a car bomb? Was it a suicide motorcycle? And so we rely on this information to sort of be safe in the region. We rely on information from a variety of other sources about, you know, medical issues and census counts as to the type and quantity of patients that are being seen by other NGOs. And essentially, you know, I do want to mention that though we are focused in building this 24/7 emergency medical clinic in Qasr, we are also focused on what the Ministry of Health in Kurdistan has requested, which is to offer medical education within the hospitals to bring expat doctors to both perform procedures, but also train the existing local staff in hospitals. In addition, I want to mention that on the rare occasion that we have a volunteer that's interested in being closer to the front line or has experience, will have to have experience with that, but is interested in continuing with that, we do have NGOs that we are partnering with to provide that service. So in some cases, a paramedic or a medical doctor may be treating casualties off of the front lines, whether it be civilian or military.
Now, if the first commandment of medicine is the Hippocratic Oath, first do no harm, the second sort of epigrammatic commandment is physician, heal thyself. And in situations like the ones that Global Outreach Doctors are in, it is not so much heal thyself as protect thyself, practice preventative medicine on yourself. Talk to me a little bit about how you talk to your doctors about monitoring their own health and energy, and what kind of intramural observation your staff does to make sure that your own people are at the top of their games physically.
Yeah, it's an interesting, important point, Dave. When we were in the Zaatari refugee camp, one of my other medical directors, Dr. Matthew, and I talked about the power of trauma acupuncture as part of our integrated approach to mental health issues. And so in the Zaatari camp, for instance, besides, of course, our main goal to treat the refugees, we also treated physicians and practitioners who were feeling stressed, who were sort of overwhelmed with the stories of what it's like to be a Syrian refugee, or hearing stories like Dr. Michael and I were listening to a young boy who said his friends were pushed off of buildings by IS and he watched. And so that sort of does become unfortunately sort of routine in what we see every day in lots of countries, but also does kind of work on your psyche. And so we use, trauma acupuncture, which is, WHO approved. The World Health Organization recognized it as a, the technique is called NADA, not a technique, and it's used for, stabilizing mental health issues. It's a physical medicine versus a, traditional psychotherapy talk, modality, which we also provide. And so we have ended up in several locations treating the practitioners that are on the ground, both our own medical practitioners and medical practitioners from other, organizations, other NGOs that are working in the region. And, you know, we're all pretty keenly aware and alert of a provider that may seem, overly stressed or seem either could be even getting physically ill from something that they ingested in the country that's not normal or whatever. And so we're, of course, trying to make sure that all of the practitioners are healthy so that we can take care of those patients that are not.
I said that Mosul was the second largest city in Iraq. It also historically was the most diverse city in Iraq. It has a Sunni majority in a Shiite majority country, but it had a considerable Shiite minority. It also had Kurds who are either sect, but ethnically distinct from the Arab population. It had a population of Turkmens. It had Yazidis. It had many of the smaller sects. It had Christians as well as Muslims. ISIS, of course, is based on Sunnis against the world, and you're either with us or you're dead. And so the diversity of the old city of Mosul has been almost under the same kind of assault as the city was physically and militarily by IS. From your talks to people who have escaped the city of Mosul, what seems to be their expectation about the future of the city as a diverse place that really united many minorities and managed to live together pretty collegially, at least until the ISIS invasion of 2014?
Well, there is such, as you said, a diverse group of religions and ethnicities all in one location. And to be honest with you, the conversations that we have are with refugees escaping IS occupation is based on their day-to-day needs, Dave. They're not so much wondering what the future of Mosul is. I mean, granted that the people that we are engaging with, the patients, that is, are not professors, you know, at a university in Iraq looking at the global health issue or political science folks wondering how Mosul is going to survive. They're sort of wondering what they're going to eat tomorrow, and they're sort of wondering how their wound or their health issue is going to be improved. And they're missing their children that have been killed. And so, you know, certainly the dialogue is important, but it's certainly at a level that is not with the folks that we engage with. Even to be honest with you, when we meet with, the Ministry of Health and we're working with International Medical Corps and a few other large organizations, you know, the focus is primarily less academic, and I don't mean to, you know, or less politically oriented and more of sort of getting by and making sure facilities are available.
One of the themes that I've seen reported again and again, and it has a real echo to me from my time in Bosnia, which had been a notably minority-majority, very diverse country before the ethnic wars broke out there in the 1990s, is the complaint of, you know who stabbed me in the back? It was my neighbor. It was people whom we dined with, every week or every month. It's people we knew and trusted. And when IS moved into town, they joined them and turned on us. And I don't know how we'll ever live together again. I am guessing that just in detailing what drove them out of town or what drove them to the medical tent for care, that theme of people we used to know and love are the very people who turned on us. Is that something that you would pick up from your work on the ground in Qasr and the nearby camps?
I think, Dave, that the trust factor is a huge issue with refugees. You know, it appears that Americans are well liked by the Kurdish people, and we have off and on been helpful to them. I can't say that American policy has always been helpful to the Kurds. They trust, in general, expats. They have a lack of trust of anybody that is outside their immediate family. And as you said, you know, a neighbor can be turned against another neighbor with the proper IS indoctrination. And so, you know, again, their trust is to get out of harm's way. And they trust being in a refugee camp. They don't have to concern about who their neighbor is. They've been segregated by the UN in different refugee camps, so they're not mixed populations. And so that sort of deals with that issue.
You mentioned the children who had seen neighbor children tossed off buildings to their deaths. In many ways, the worst burden of war is witnessing the things that ordinary people are forced to watch or forced to see during war is something that changes them for a lifetime and can really psychologically cripple them for months and years after the event. That kind of psychological trauma, I am guessing, is pretty high on your list of things that you and your fellow doctors need to pay attention to.
Yes, the mental health is a critical component of the humanitarian effort around the world. Based on what these folks have witnessed, the organization DAMA, D-A-M-A, and a few others are focused on that. We are working in conjunction with them to provide, our physical mental health treatments. But it certainly is influencing the future population of, you know, the survivors that will eventually be the workforce, maybe, hopefully, the leaders that can make some changes in the future in these countries. But it is very troubling. It is very difficult. I mean, the young boy you talked about that described his friends being pushed off buildings sort of talked about it as he giggled, which is sort of a defense mechanism, right? So he's sort of slightly laughing while he's talking about it. And it's brutal. You know, we visited, and unfortunately, it's more and more common, you know, young men with their legs blown off. And they're considered the fortunate ones because we're visiting them in hospitals that are, you know, those are getting treated. And, you know, we're talking to individuals that have had their legs blown off that are in wheelchairs and they actually, you know, inshallah, thank God that everything worked out okay. Here I am. There they are with no legs and sometimes no legs and missing an arm or two. So it's going from, of course, the mental health to the physical, and of course the physical that causes the mental health issues. You know, it's all got to be treated, and as an alternative, you know, as an integrative practitioner, we look at the entire body. We don't separate the physical from the mental. It's important to treat the whole patient.
And also you have to see the patient in a timeline, people who have lost limbs like that. And we know that in the United States for the many veterans who return from Iraq or Afghanistan, having been victimized by IEDs, explosive mines and bombs, and lost legs, that they require a lifetime of care and assistance. And this presents both a psychological and an economic burden on them and their families. We'll talk about that, and we'll talk about the so-called ripple effect of President Trump's ban on immigration rights to refugees and to residents of seven Muslim-majority countries, one of which is Iraq. But first, we're going to take another brief pause. This is Here and There. I'm Dave Merritt. And our guest is Dr. Andrew Lustig of Global Outreach Doctors. We'll be back with more right after these messages. Welcome back again to Here and There. I'm Dave Marish, and our guest is Dr. Andrew Lustig, a proud resident of Santa Fe, New Mexico, and the leader of the Global Outreach Doctors NGO, which goes around the world trying to relieve the troubles of people who have suffered traumas from everything from earthquakes and typhoons to modern warfare. Even in the United States, a very rich and very well-equipped country, it has been a difficult adjustment for the families of veterans who have lifetime disabling injuries, like loss of legs or arms. In Iraq, an immeasurably poorer country, whose lesser facilities, particularly in the Mosul area, are being devastated by war, I guess part of your treatment has to be to help them prepare and help their families prepare for a changed lifetime that has been redefined by the wounds of war.
Right. I mean, one of the things that's, you know, a big ethical concern of ours that our medical directors and I and our other physicians talk about is sort of a sustainable long-term approach to what we're doing. And that includes being involved, not necessarily directly, but as partners with sort of life skills that these refugees need to start focusing on so that they can be a productive member of a society that they are eventually released in. I mentioned earlier, Dave, that one of our partners in Kurdistan, Iraq, is Bring Hope Foundation. And our friend Dr. Marwin, who runs that, has developed, along with Nicholas, a program to create life skills for the refugees. So, for instance, on a few of the days that we were there for almost a month, we visited a sewing project, a project that is being set up to provide sewing machines to Kurdish refugees to produce goods out of recycled material that is then later sold in Western world countries with a monogram produced by Kurdish refugees. And so you might see a truckload of ripped Walmart bags that turned inside out become sewn into a handbag. You know, you might see discarded camp tents that whose fabric is reused and turned into something useful. And so while not directly involved, you know, we certainly support with our partners projects that let refugees have a future. There is another partner that we work with that is introducing soccer to these refugee camps so that these young children have soccer fields, you know, albeit that they're dirt, they're not grass, and I played soccer with a few of the young boys, to give them some recreation, to take their mind off of their troubles. And actually, this particular soccer project is being led by a known soccer professional who hopes to give hope to one or more of these boys on a regular basis that they perhaps might in the future play, you know, semi-professional soccer. So it is really important that the future be bright for people that have witnessed such difficult calamity, that there's a way that they can move on, that they are sort of in the sewing project, you know, the women are using tactile, you know, focus on very, you know, detailed work, which sort of takes them out of the world they're in and puts them in the world of, you know, a thread and a needle. And ultimately, provide some sort of long-term income when these products get sold overseas, because they've been labeled, sewn by Kurdish refugees. And so, you know, super important, because if the children are the future of those countries, and the adults that educate them, that are in those refugees, you know, that are role models, also need to sort of show them that there's hope. Critical to sort of what's next for all of these thousands and thousands of refugees.
Were you still in Iraq when President Trump announced his ban on immigration of refugees and a 90-day minimum hold on any immigrants from Iraq and six other Muslim-majority countries? We're reading that American military people in Iraq are saying that their relationships with their Iraqi counterparts are already showing signs of strain and damage. Did you pick up a vibe of shock or resentment from ordinary Iraqis as a result of the president's announcements?
You know, as a matter of fact, I did. I was in the country when that ban was, I was in Iraq when that ban was announced. There seemed to be a bit of confusion amongst the NGO community about whether, you know, an American with a passport was going to be sort of held up in question a little bit longer than usual after coming out of Iraq. Obviously, if you're an American citizen, you'll make it back to America, but the process could take you a little bit longer. And talking to everybody from, you know, Iraqi cab drivers to refugees, you know, interestingly enough, they seem supportive of Trump, and we were in Kurdistan, which is almost a separate part of Iraq than Baghdad, right? So the Kurds felt, oh, well, America loves us, and that applies to Baghdad and Iraq, and we're Kurdistan. I mean, I heard that a lot. And so I think there's sort of mixed feelings. I have also witnessed and seen sort of the question about Iraqi military feeling unwelcome. There's been a couple of videos that have gone viral on that topic. I'm not sure 100% that that's exactly accurate. Don't forget, the American military and the Iraqi military are coordinating the airstrikes and coordinating the push against IS. We were in a village that was completely decimated, 20 kilometers from Mosul, and you know, you could see where all the airstrikes were. Those airstrikes were most likely called in by Peshmerga. We had met with the Peshmerga. They're most likely called in by Peshmerga to the Allied forces, and you could tell which buildings were, you know, completely obliterated by an airstrike, and which were, destroyed by, you know, more local devices. So I think my answer to your question is that, you know, the Americans are providing a lot of training and coordination directly with the Iraqi military, and that continues, and that relationship is relied upon, and the Kurds rely on us for support against IS. And so sort of to wonder whether they would turn against us because of this ban, which doesn't exactly affect, you know, flying out of Erbil, but would affect flying out of Baghdad. And my feeling is they're seeing more good than bad from America. And that does not mean I support one bit the ban. I'm just commenting on, you know, what I believe is the feeling from the Iraqi people that I've met.
Well, you know, we usually use the phrase lightly when we say can't live with them, can't live without them. But when both sides of that equation are real, and real in a life and death sense of dependency and a future triumph, it's a most uncomfortable situation. And one gathers that for Americans working in Iraq, particularly American military and American government officials, and among Iraqi citizens, the immigration ban does complicate a mutually dependent and mutually crucial relationship. I want to thank our guest, Dr. Andrew Lustig of Global Outreach Doctors, first of all for his great work and the great work of his medical team, but also for once again sharing his experiences with us on Here and There. Andrew, thanks so much for being with us.
Thank you, Dave.
That's our story for today. I'm Dave Marish. Research and production assistance for Here and There by Amy Marish and Mary Lou Cooper. Operational control by Will Floyd and Sean Conlon. Our theme is by Kate Powell. Here and There is a production of KSFR-FM 101.1 in Santa Fe, New Mexico. You can access podcasts of our programs at the KSFR.org website or on iTunes, search Dave Marish, or at our own website, davemarish.com. You can follow us on Twitter, at Dave Marish, KSFR, and on Facebook, at Here and There with Dave Marish. Join us again when next we go Here and There in search of news. Here and There is funded in part by the Reva and David Logan Foundation, keeping watch for the strategies that help create a more informed and just future for all.